The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The FRB 121102, that's like 3 billion light years away. So that's a huge signal.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all to the Micah Hanks program. Glad, as always, to be your host as we go spinning cosmogirally through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, and listen on demand via podcast apps everywhere. So let's lock in. Question: what if scientists observed in space for the very first time? Here's a hint, it's something of the quantum variety, also giant crocodile ancestors, and much more in the way of news. Also, a little later, a drop-in here in the bunker from a couple of gents who I'm sure you'll be hearing more from in the weeks to come. But while the pandemic has shut Earth's eyes on the skies, at least as far as astronomers and their accessibility to observatories, a lot of unique discoveries have been made. And so, Vice reporter Becky Ferreira will be joining us to talk about what scientists have found in deep space that is sending signals to Earth in steady cycles. What does this mean? And what do astronomers think we could be looking at? Becky will give us her insights about this. And, of course, we've got the big news that a group of scientists in new research have claimed there may be 36 alien civilizations in their estimates that could be communicating in our galaxy. So yeah, we've got a lot to cover this week. First and foremost, as always, I hope you guys are all great out there. I hope everyone is doing well. It was a quiet weekend over here on my end of things, locked down in the bunker and working on writing projects. You know, it's rare for me these days to be able to have a little time to get caught up on things. It's important, I think, for the sake of mental health, to be able to just have some you time, right? And I hope you guys have had a little of that, although many people, I guess, with the last few months behind us, social distancing, sheltering in place, and self-quarantining, yeah, by now you may be tired of having all of that time to yourself. Just remember, if you're getting out there, you're enjoying the weather, and you're finally reconnecting with people face-to-face, do so at a distance. Observe safety guidelines. Recent reports have indicated that as people are slowly getting back out there, as businesses are opening, we have seen a few spikes in coronavirus infections and even hospitalizations. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo saying that if indeed we continue to see a rise in infections, some of the safeguards that have been imposed in the last few months may have to be reinstated. And don't forget, especially in major metropolitan areas, you could actually be cited if you are not observing the safety guidelines. We are still in the midst of a pandemic. Things may be somewhat normal within reason for the next few months. In likelihood, with the coming of winter, it's going to get bad again. So enjoy yourselves, but please do so responsibly. These are unusual times that we're in, and I think it's going to remain that way for a little while. But moving away from earthly affairs, all the chaos that has ensued in recent weeks here on planet Earth, scientists have observed something interesting in space. And if you're like me, back when you were in school, you were probably taught that there were four states of matter, right? Solids, liquids, gas, and then plasmas. But of course, there is that enigmatic and elusive fifth state of matter, which had been observed here on Earth, but not in space, at least until recently. And as PhysOrg reports, scientists now say that they have observed the fifth state of matter in space for the first time, and that in doing so, we have moved one step closer to perhaps solving some of the previously unplumbable universal mysteries. Now, PhysOrg fills us in. on what are known as Bose-Einstein condensates, or BECs, the existence of which was predicted by the late great Albert Einstein and also Indian mathematician Satyendra Nath Bose almost a century ago. And these are formed when atoms of certain elements are cooled to near absolute zero. At this point, the atoms become a single entity with quantum properties, wherein each particle also functions as a wave of matter. And one of the things that makes these so-called BECs so interesting is the way that they seem to kind of hang in this liminal space between forces like gravity and those elements of the quantum world. And because of this, scientists think that the BECs contain some clues to things like dark energy. In other words, the unknown energy thought to be behind the universe's accelerating expansion. Remember that with all the things happening in the universe, there's a whole lot we can observe, but not enough to explain all of the forces that appear to be at work, and therefore this idea of dark energy has been implemented in order to account for all of that. Now, BECs may help us understand that, but part of the problem with studying them is the fact that they are extremely fragile. According to PhysOrg, the slightest interaction with the external world is enough to warm them past their condensation threshold, and this makes them nearly impossible for scientists to study, at least on Earth, because gravity interferes with magnetic fields that are required to hold them in place for observation. And so where better to take experiments than into space? And on Thursday, a team of NASA scientists unveiled the first results from BEC experiments that have been taking place aboard the International Space Station, where particles can be manipulated free from earthly constraints. According to Robert Thompson of the Pasadena-based California Institute of Technology, microgravity allows us to confine atoms with much weaker forces since we don't have to support them against gravity. And in this era where companies like SpaceX are getting more and more involved in what's going on in space, it's only a matter of time before we are more regularly able to conduct experiments like this, and rather than becoming something that are only done on occasion, they may become the norm. In fact, conducting experiments on the International Space Station may not be all that we're able to do in the coming years. If Elon Musk has anything to say about it, we may be conducting experiments on Mars. We know the kind of constraints of Earth gravity on these sorts of experiments. What about Mars gravity? Soon, maybe we will have the answer. You know, I look back to the ancient past. I was doing some writing and research this past weekend about human evolution and some of the archaic human types. And it must have been a very strange world back in the middle of the Pleistocene, the last ice age, when humans shared the Earth with other varieties of hominins, other bipedal cousins of the archaic variety. And that's not all they shared the world with. We also had megafaunal species like mastodons, mammoth, short-faced bear, dire wolves, American lions, American camels. Did you know there used to be camels in America? What about megafaunal turkeys? You know, I see a lot of turkeys in my neighborhood, and the way that they behave is sort of like dinosaurs, little bipedal dinosaurs running around, something akin to a Compos ignathus. But if we go really far back, well before humans ever arrived on the scene, we had much more frightening giant reptiles, like, for instance, the one that's been discussed recently over at Science Alert. And this specimen, believed to be an ancient relative of the crocodile, may, like the turkeys in my neighborhood, have actually walked on two legs. Now, crocodiles are frightening enough, especially the really big ones. I've spent some time down there on the South Carolina coast on islands like Dolfusky, where sometimes you have 14-foot alligators. And they always warn you, keep a distance. Of course, you guys know me, I love to watch nature, and that includes potentially deadly giant reptiles. And so I always am cautious when I'm looking at a 14 or 15-foot gator out there in a pond on a golf course or something along those lines. One of the stories they told me down there on the island was that there was a man a few years ago who was chased by one of these 14-foot alligators. And while they're in the water, of course, they're incredibly formidable, but even when they are on land, they are capable of moving at speeds, in short bursts, of up to about 35 miles per hour. And the only thing I could imagine more frightening than being chased by a giant lizard that is capable of ripping me to shreds is one that might move on two legs. Now, coming back over to Science Alert, Carly Casella reports that that kind of scene, understandably, is hard to imagine, but not so much because it is only the kind of thing that most of us experience in our nightmares. No, it's because crocodiles have the reputation for having gone relatively unchanged through millions of years of evolution. You often hear this. They are the closest thing to living dinosaurs that we have on Earth today. And while that is true, that isn't necessarily to say that they have not changed, and that they have been around essentially for millions of years and have always looked the way that they do. In fact, as she reports, so ingrained has our concept of a four-legged crocodile become that experts nearly overlooked this ancient bipedal relative completely while researching fossilized prints in the Jinju Formation in what is now South Korea. The story goes like this. Paleontologists first thought that this set of fossilized tracks, which includes nearly 100 extraordinarily preserved prints, belonged to an ancient, get this, flying reptile, a pterosaur, which they thought might have been giving its wings a quick break as it strolled along a mudflat. Upon closer inspection, however, the fossil indentations began to look oddly familiar. They noted that in the heel on one of the prints, scientists found a clear impression of scales. That wasn't something that they were expecting. Now, they note that dinosaurs and their bird descendants walk on their toes. The fact that there was a heel present in this print and that there were scales on it definitely suggested we were looking at something different. And according to expert Kyung-Soo Kim from Chinju National University of Education in South Korea, crocodiles walk on the flat of their feet, leaving clear heel impressions like humans do. And so, on further inspection, these prints certainly did appear to be those of a crocodile, but they also appeared to be of the bipedal variety. Because as the researchers continued to look, they couldn't find those easily recognizable handprints, or the forefeet, of the crocodile. While the animals can sometimes walk over the prints of their front limbs with their hind limbs, a concept called overprinting, the team found no evidence of that at this site. In other words, this ancient variety of crocodile appeared to be walking on two legs. Carefully analyzing these impressions, it became clear that while the creatures had been moving on two legs in the same way many dinosaurs once did, the footprints didn't actually belong to a dinosaur, but modern crocodile locomotion didn't match either. Typical crocodiles walk in a squat stance and create trackways that are wide, explains Kim. Oddly, our trackways are very narrow-looking, more like a crocodile balancing on a tightrope. As the article notes, that's an unusual gait, especially for such a big creature. The size of the footprints, roughly 18 to 24 centimeters, indicates this ancient reptile stood up to 3 meters long, with legs about the same height as those of an adult human. Carly further notes that as wild as this seems at first, there might actually be precedent for such an amazing feat of balance among other ancient crocodilomorphs, and that being the family that includes both modern crocodiles and, of course, their extinct ancestors. But I want to add one more interpretation here. Again, I'm no expert, but you guys know that I like to speculate on issues related to science. In this case, clearly we have the footprints in the mud, and clearly it seems to indicate bipedal walking. But does that necessarily mean that the creature was entirely out of the water when it left those prints? Might another possibility be that the creature was actually in shallow water, and that as it was propelling itself along on its hind feet, it left impressions while its front feet were tucked up under its body for buoyancy, or perhaps even actually paddling in order to help propel the creature through the water, although presumably the tail would do a fine job with that by itself. If you've ever actually watched alligators and crocodiles as they swim, the large tail is the main propellant as they move through the water. And they will tend to use their legs both to help steer, but also kind of tucked up behind them so that they can cruise through the water more efficiently. And again, I'm not the expert, but perhaps this is one way of looking at why these prints might appear in bipedal fashion. It might not necessarily mean that that was a common means of locomotion, but it could also represent a creature that was in a semi-aqueous environment, and it was propelling itself through water shallow enough that its hind feet were able to leave impressions in the soft mud below. Hey, it's just a thought. But again, I'm not the expert. Now, the teams who have studied these footprints have now assigned them to a potentially new species. They call it Bactrochopus grandis. If they are right, no other Bactrochopus ichno species, again, a species identified from trace fossils, that is, the footprints they leave behind. And for more on that, refer to the forthcoming complete interview with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum that I'll be featuring on a podcast you'll be hearing more about in just a bit. But again, it is believed that if this is a new species, Bactrochopus, Grandis. This is the first time it's been described in such detail, and these footprints are the largest Bactrotropus sample currently known. But if we are looking at an ancient crocodilian ancestor that walked on two legs, it reminds us a little of the traditional idea in myth and folklore about dragons. And dragons, in traditional mythological representations, often live in caves. And one variety of real dragon, so to speak, recently made an appearance in a cave, as was brought to my attention by Lauren. And as IFL Science reports, the Postojna Cave in Slovenia, which is a karst cave formed from drops of water eroding rock over the course of millions of years, this cave has been the secret home of a science experiment now for years, involving a clutch of baby dragons. You know, there's always that question of what you call a group of animals. A pack of wolves, a pride of lions, a murder of crows. So what would you call a group of dragons? Well, this one is called a clutch of baby dragons. But these precious baby dragons are actually creatures known as olms. These are ancient aquatic salamanders that breed only once every decade and can live to be 100 years old. They were first described by the naturalist Valvasor in 1689, who wrote in his book The Glory of the Duchy of Carniola that after heavy rains, olms would wash up from underground water systems and were believed by locals to be dragons. Well, baby dragons, whose offspring had been swept out of the caves and washed onto the ground above. Now, as far as salamanders go, heck, as far as dragons go, these little creatures, which are described as being ghostly in appearance, are incredibly rare. But in 2016, an olm at the cave lay around 60 eggs in an observation tank, which offered cave authorities a very rare opportunity to protect and study them. Of the 21 eggs which survived, three of these will star in an observation tank open to visitors at the Postojna cave. And as very precious residents, cave authorities kept the olms out of sight in their laboratory, but soon a limited number of 30 visitors will be permitted to visit the baby dragons each day as the cave opens its doors to the public. You know, there's a cave very close to me that has similar viewing hours. Once a year, scientists and small groups of the public, only by invitation, I believe, or you had to sign up and be kind of part of a lottery to be able to qualify to go in. But there's a cave right up the mountain from me, appropriately known as Bat Cave, where you could go into this large cave and you could observe up to 5 different bat species that reside there. Of course, in light of current events and the known origins of the coronavirus, I don't know how often people will be entering Bat Cave to study its winged residents. That may be a different story altogether. But if you happen to be anywhere near Slovenia, you might be able to drop by Postojna Cave and see the baby dragons on display there. You know, another idea in antiquity. I've always liked archaic words for things that still exist in the modern world. And although the dragons that are known to exist are relegated to the tiny variety, unless, of course, we consider some of the unique claims about sea serpents from over the years, maybe if there's anything out there in the natural world that either does or ever did exist, if some of the stories about sea serpents are true, that might be more akin to an actual dragon. And if they were ever proven, it wouldn't be the first time that something that was observed in nature gave rise to creatures that were assigned to the mythical category. I suspect that there are a lot of animals over time that might have been assigned to the area of myth and folklore, but for which actual observations of little understood, unrecognized species might have served as the real inspiration. Another idea is the notion that the kraken from ancient medieval texts actually involved real observations of giant squid. But as far as ancient names for creatures known to exist, one of my favorites is the idea of the asp, that is, the snake. And although it is an archaic term that is borrowed from the Latin aspis, which actually I think comes from the Greek, there are certain varieties of snakes today that retain this name. For instance, a small southern European viper with an upturned snout is known as an asp. Sometimes Egyptian cobras are also referred to as asps, but these days we know them as snakes. Now, you may also have heard of the old idea of snake oil, right? Like the old medicine man who's pandering snake oil, this being a term for a alleged curative or remedy, which in fact has no basis in science. But what if I told you that one of the greatest scientists of all time once had a recipe that we might liken to snake oil, only even more disgusting? That's right, Live Science actually reports here that Sir Isaac Newton, famous for developing the three laws of motion and advancing calculus, apparently had a far-out idea for how to treat the Black Plague. No, it wasn't snake oil, it was even worse, it was toad vomit. And he presumed that toad vomit lozenges might be an effective cure for the plague. According to the article here, in addition to recommending a number of gemstone amulets against the plague, he gave detailed instructions on how to make the putrid toad vomit treatment, according to two unpublished pages handwritten by Newton that are now on the auction block. Yeah, that would be quite a collector's item, wouldn't it? One of the most forward-thinking and greatest scientists of all time, who had proposed that toad vomit lozenges might prevent the plague. Apparently, Newton describes in detail how to suspend a toad by its legs in a chimney for 3 days until it vomits up earth with various insects in it. This vomit must be caught on a dish of yellow wax. Hey, you gotta follow the protocols, right? Then after the toad dies, its body should be turned into powder, mixed with the vomit and a serum, and made into lozenges and worn about the affected area. This treatment would drive away the contagion and draw out the poison. You know, I'm not sure if that really would drive away the contagion. I think it might drive away people. It would keep people from coming near you. This toad treatment apparently was best if someone was in a pinch. Then amulets made out of the gemstones, hyacinth, sapphire, or amber could also serve as antidotes. If I had to choose, and I had access to the gemstones, I might go with those. But of course, despite his advances in the world of physics and his mastery of principles of nature, even Newton wasn't infallible. Again, you look at all the people these days who are very scientifically trained but may believe in strange things. On the other hand, you have people who are very scientifically trained who also seem to lack any fundamental interest in some unique ideas that might exist in the world of zoology. For instance, when you have, over time, an abundance of sightings of an alleged animal species, it is interesting that many scientists are content to explain that as being either pure folklore and mythology, or at worst, simply hoaxes. But could there be a little more to this story? And should citizen scientists be involved in the gathering of data about these alleged cryptozoological species? I mean, we have to entertain the possibility at times, at least when evidence is in abundance. And so when we come back after this, a couple of pals will be joining me here in studio for a segment to talk about that right here on the Micah Hanks program. Do animals still exist in the world that are unrecognized by modern science? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, keeping you company every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. And joining me now in the studio are a couple of gentlemen I have been eager to introduce to this audience because we have a big announcement to make, and we've teased it already enough. It's time to lay all the cards out on the table, face up, and get this game rolling. Now, the gentleman that I'm about to introduce will already be familiar to this audience. In fact, one of them has been on the show in recent weeks, but we're going to introduce the old first and then get back around to the new. Dakota Waddell, longtime friend of mine. He is the bassist who I have performed with in bands like Nitrograss over the years for more than a decade. You and I have traveled around the Southeast performing, but we also have shared an interest in the topic of a new forthcoming podcast endeavor we'll be launching. So welcome back to the bunker, Smokey.
What's happening, man? How you been?
It's good to see you here in the studio, in the newly redesigned studio. Less moldy, less water dripping off the stone walls.
Yeah, you really cleaned up. Did you buy some bleach or something? It looks great in here.
A lot of bleach, yeah. Well, you know, I've had the last few months to do nothing but just stay here and work.
Just sitting here buying black market Lysol off of eBay right now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's kind of what happens in these strange times. Now, you and I have a long-held interest in the topic of cryptozoology, and more importantly, America's famous reliktominoid, the Sasquatch. And so, again, you and I, for a while, were co-hosting a podcast for X subscribers called Crypto X. That was years ago. Kind of just started as a fun side project, more than anything, just an excuse for us to be able to get on the mic together from time to time. But I've had people continue to ask, whatever happened to that show? Would you ever consider bringing it back? Funny thing is, you'd proposed that, what was it like, a couple of years ago?
It's been a little while, yeah, a year or two ago.
Yeah, and so it's all been a matter of timing, reformatting, restructuring the show, and of course making it something that could be publicly available for all, because that's the whole idea. I wanted to make sure that we had a project that everyone could enjoy if we're going to talk about this subject, because one of our focuses has really been to try and incorporate more citizen science. You know, again, the listeners of this show know I'm kind of on the fence when it comes to the idea of Sasquatch, but I see a lot of opportunities for education with this, you know, encouraging people to get out there in the forest to learn general science education. Also to learn critical thinking. I've often seen, especially in anthropology classes, professors use the idea of Sasquatch as a vehicle for instructing students on critical thinking. And so finding that balance between that potential belief, but also some measured skepticism, would be important to all of this too.
Yeah, another thing that we kind of talked about that all goes hand in hand with this when it comes to being outdoors is not only everything that you're talking about, but survival skills and even situational observation about being able to go out. And we were talking earlier about tracking something.
Yep.
If the you're following footprints, well, what if the footprints end? Well, does it just end there? No, you keep looking for clues, and that's all about like being aware of your surroundings. And we are proponents of citizen science, and that's what we're trying to relay to our audience.
Yes, it covers all of the things that you just touched on, and of course, it allows people to dig into those things with a subject that's fun, too. What's also fun, though, is the other gentleman who is sitting here in the studio, you bringing him into the fold. Dakota had talked about Jeff Smith for a while, and we'd met for coffee a few times. In fact, we actually all attended a Sasquatch festival together. But Jeff has been an incredible resource because with your background in the U.S. Air Force, that, of course, lent itself to another conversation we had here on the main show with Brett Tingley a few weeks ago. So welcome back to you, Jeff Smith.
Thank you very much. I must say the ride down the elevator to the bunker gets easier every time.
It certainly does. And we've been hard at work in recent weeks, haven't we, gentlemen? We've been recording and researching and interviewing. It's been a lot going into preparation for this new podcast, which, at least on the public shows, we have not actually officially announced, and I thought, what better time to do that than with you guys right here in the studio? There was a lot of thought that went into this. Dakota, of course, the original supplemental show we were doing was called Crypto X, but I was very influenced a while back by a science paper that had been written for the Relict Hominoid Inquiry, which is, of course, the online journal produced by Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum of Idaho State University. He and the late Dr. John Bendernagel wrote an article saying, well, first of all, Sasquatch should be studied outside of cryptozoology because we think this is a matter of zoology and anthropology. But also, we think that at times, if that subject is to be taken seriously, it may not necessarily be benefited from being treated as a cryptozoological subject. I thought a lot about that, and as I've expressed to a few people, there was this kind of aha moment for me where I reached out to Dakota. What's your favorite cryptid, quote unquote? Jeff, what's your favorite cryptid? Went to the Seven Ages guys. Jason James, you know, name your number one and your number two. And of course, no survey would be complete without asking the lovely assistant Lauren, what's your favorite? Everybody's unanimous response was Sasquatch, mine too. And as much as we've discussed that in the past on this show, as much as it is a mutual interest of all of us, it kind of became evident to me we should really take the show in that direction. It should be the main focus. We should get more citizen science, more science in general, you know, get the perspectives from academics, trained professionals, you know, some skeptics too, and also those who are a little more on the speculative side, but really kind of cover the entire topic as comprehensively as we can and in a way that I don't see other podcasts doing. And so, the project that has been in the works for quite some time now, it's about ready for launch, and we have a name for it too. And that name is Sasquatch Tracks. So the new podcast will be called Sasquatch Tracks, available at sasquatchtracks.com and available for free about once a month or so on all podcasting apps. Of course, you'll find it on Google, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere podcasts can be found.
And I'm extremely excited about this. It's going to be a really fun endeavor.
It's kind of been a long time in the making, but here it is, and we're giving it back to you.
Yes.
The people.
And again, that's another important thing, too. I've been talking with the guys a lot about this. You know, having the perspectives of, you know, qualified scientists, naturalists, you know, people who are outdoor specialists, people who are journalists, people from all different professions and walks of life who have looked at this, that's a really important aspect of it, just like what we do on this show. But to be able to have a little fun, too, to be able to have some humor. You know, one of my favorite segments that I think we've done in one of the episodes we've recorded thus far was Jeff's survey of different alleged institutes and programs online that claim to offer cryptozoological degrees. And we had a whole lot of fun looking at that. And of course, advising why you should, rather than going online and getting a phony degree in what many consider to be a pseudoscientific subject, why you should actually study real science, get an actual degree in biology, zoology, anthropology, primatology, and really seriously study these things. If we are to advance the narrative and human knowledge about these subjects, but they are less often studied by the sciences, the best thing, in my opinion, is for scientists, qualified scientists, to study them.
And I want to just go ahead and say, like, we're not here to convince you one way or the other that Sasquatch is a real thing. I mean, I'm with Micah on this. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that points to the existence. I can't say definitively one way or the other. I mean, I'm just a skeptical, and I sit on the fence sometimes as well. Talking about everybody's favorite cryptid, you can laugh at it. And a lot of people, when you mention to them, it's just like, oh, yeah. Well, you think Bigfoot's real? They may laugh one way or the other, but they still think it's interesting as well. And I've had that happen with so many people lately.
That is a really important point. I often say that, too. People kind of, you know, jab me. Do you believe in this? You don't believe in this, do you? Well, first, I would love to. I really want to think that the creature's out there. I'll make absolutely no apologies for my interest in the subject and my desire for there to be one, but I reserve judgment and say I will have to see more evidence before I say that I absolutely say, yeah, I think it's out there. Again, I'd like to see more evidence before I would draw that conclusion. But even if I ride that fence, as we say, and remain in that sort of middle position on the issue of whether it exists or not, I still enjoy the topic. I think a lot of people enjoy this topic. You know, Blake Smith and the folks at Monster Talk, which is a skeptically oriented cryptozoology podcast and a really good one. Blake is one of those guys who, in addition to just being a great guy, he is a skeptic, but he really enjoys the subject. And there are a lot of skeptics who enjoy this topic. So I think for a lot of people, we're trying to produce a podcast that whether you are on the side of belief or if you're more skeptically inclined, you're still going to enjoy the conversations we have, the interviews that we present, the segments we produce, and there's going to be a lot of conversation you don't hear on the other podcasts. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, we're not going to convince anybody necessarily. We'll provide you the information that we've discovered and let you make your decision about it. But personally, I want to see one.
I want to see one too. But again, actually, I would hope that maybe we will have conversations and perhaps there will be some opportunities for gathering information, you know, producing content, conducting interviews that maybe actually not only will be compelling to us, but maybe some people who have been extremely critical toward this subject in the past, oh, come on, that's just nonsense. Maybe they'll hear some of these conversations and say, you know, you guys raised a fair point. Maybe there is at least something more worthy of consideration after all. I would love for some people to kind of come at this with maybe we'll say low expectations for the subject and come away thinking a little differently about it.
If nothing else, one of my hopes is just maybe to be the catalyst for you to go outside and learn about situational awareness and to just look at the whole world around you. Just don't take things at face value and learn to do your own research.
Yeah. And again, Jeff has been, for instance, following up with a lot of regional coordinators with the National Park Service. And I'm sure we're going to do a segment about that on
I hope so.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a segment on a forthcoming show. But some of the emails that Jeff has gotten from members of the National Park Service here just in Western North Carolina have been really interesting. One had written back to you and said, we encourage Sasquatch research, but his reason for that wasn't because he expects someone to find these creatures or even believes that they exist. No, he says this, of course, is something that encourages people to get out there and enjoy the beauty of our national forests And he says, if it takes people searching for a creature that may be mythical to get them out there in the woods, we are all for that. So some of the responses have been really interesting, and it shows that even those who are more skeptically inclined still see some value in the Sasquatch interest.
Yeah, well, I mean, people working in the Forest Service, people working in the national parks, they're people just like us. They have their own interest. Sure, some of them are probably not going to be interested in the subject, but I'm sure there are quite a few out there who are, and maybe some of them have had their own experiences as well.
And on that topic, something that we have instituted already on the website, SasquatchTracks.com, which as of the time that you will be getting this, if you're downloading this as a podcast, you'll be able to visit SasquatchTracks.com and you'll see not only the new episodes of the podcast, but also the feature that we have implemented, which is a sightings report form. If you or someone that you know thinks that they have seen anything in nature that would be of interest to us, but of course, especially an alleged Sasquatch sighting, you can actually submit a report to us via email through the website right there. So that's something else that we want to encourage people to do is get active, share their stories, put the word out there, and of course, enjoy what I think is going to be a really fun podcast. So fellas, we've got quite an adventure ahead of us. Welcome aboard. Looking forward to it.
Oh yeah.
Tally-ho.
Indeed. And thank you both for being here in the studio with me for this special segment on the Micah Hanks program. When we come back, we're going to get back into a little bit of news. And then later in the program, of course, Becky Ferreira will be joining us to discuss the mystery of fast radio bursts. A lot of interesting discoveries going on right now in the sciences. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Micah Hanks program. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Thanks again to Jeff and Smokey for dropping by. We hope you guys will be enjoying the new podcast. Three episodes right from the start. We'll have another one up here in the next couple of weeks, and then thereafter it should be about once a month from time to time if there's a lot happening or we just have a lot to say. There may be more frequent episodes. One of the many fun contributions from Team Hanks here in the bunker. So thanks to all of you out there who contribute in every way that you do. And in fact, actually on that note, listener emails, after the show about mystery booms last week, I did get a few reports from folks. Also, Tara wrote in, Micah, your podcast is fantastic and I look forward to it each week. Nice to hear someone with a similarly inquisitive point of view. I loved the Mystery Booms episode this past week, and being from Philly, I was totally into the Mystery Booms in Upper Bucks County a couple of years ago. However, that mystery was solved a few months after it began, which is described in the link below, and she sends along an article. In fact, a couple of others sent that article along. Indeed, there were two perpetrators in that case who ended up being investigated and then were arrested, and they were named. Tara also continues and mentions that she's sending this along because I didn't hear you mention the culprits. Not sure about the booms happening nowadays, though. That mystery persists. So thank you, Tara, for sending that along. And indeed, there are often explanations for the mystery booms. I maintain that some of the strange sounds that we hear in nature probably do have geological origins. And especially in the case with the frost quakes, the cryoseisms that occur in the wintertime, this is absolutely a natural phenomenon. But when someone is detonating something, that too can explain a mystery boom, and in my own case, the story I told about experiencing that mystery boom at Ohio's Great Serpent Mound, I can't be 100% sure, but Jason and James and I, we all thought that what we heard was some kind of a detonation, maybe artillery, and again, James Waldo, with 27 years in the U.S. military, would probably know if that was indeed what we had heard. So both he and Jason thought that And nearby at Chillicothe, we know that there are controlled detonations that occur. And so, in many cases, I actually think that the mystery booms can be explained by controlled detonations, explosions, or in the case in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, there had been someone behind the explosions, he and his girlfriend, I believe, and they were later arrested. So thank you for adding that. And I think that in most cases with the mystery booms, if we look into their possible cause, we will usually find explanations along these lines. Most of the strange sounds recorded in nature probably have common explanations if one knows where to look. But something else that kind of interests me is the fact that in that case in 2018, the FBI had been involved, and it had gotten me thinking it would be interesting to do a FOIA request to the FBI for information about mystery booms that they've investigated. Although admittedly, in the past, I've had very little success when it comes to FOIA requests with that particular bureau. They've instituted a different kind of system now where it's almost all done online. Every response, rather than being written, is a whole page of possible responses, and then they check the one that is closest to what they want to tell you. And like a lot of other researchers out there over the years who have looked into the disappearance of the young boy, Dennis Lloyd Martin, over in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, I've been one of the frustrated individuals who has tried to access documents that the FBI has about that, which they refuse after 51 years to release to the public. And they've got a lot of files on it. It's very interesting. I have sent FOIA requests to almost every branch of government. Actually, no. I think at this point I have appealed to every branch of government that was involved at that time. Air National Guard, National Park Service, and yes, the FBI. And every one of those agencies has gotten back to me at least within a few months, never have been able to find anything. But the FBI is the only agency that actually does have documents related to that case, which they won't release. Tim McMillan has tried to get them. Mike Bouchard has tried to get them. Researcher David Politis has tried to get them, and a number of others. And of course, currently I happen to know that one researcher is involved in an appeal process to try and see if, after more than half a century at this point, there isn't an argument to be made for their public release. Although, in truth, I could see why the FBI might want to withhold some of the files. In likelihood, it's because they have to do with individuals who are still alive, family members of Dennis, who was never recovered. Again, for those who aren't familiar with the story, if you head over to MicahHanks.com and then you click the link at the upper right-hand corner of the page where it says blog, you can read an article there on my blog, a very lengthy update I did last summer marking the 50th anniversary since Dennis vanished. And if you read that article I did, you'll see why I'm interested in this case. You'll see why a lot of people who are interested in the unexplained have taken interest in this. I've had some people write to me in the past and say, you know, these missing person cases just aren't really all that interesting. I don't know why you keep talking about them. But you have to remember that the Dennis Lloyd Martin case had actually been the cornerstone for researcher David Politis when he got involved in the whole missing 411 thing. He's written numerous books about it, but as he will tell you, one of the earliest cases that he investigated was the Dennis Martin disappearance, and it remains one of the preeminent cases in his catalog that he has investigated over the years. Now, I also have some different opinions about that case than Mr. Politis does. I think that there have been little snippets and interviews at times, and then there have been newspaper articles that have been published that have allowed aspects of the story to be kind of twisted and misshapen. At the end of the day, we still don't know what happened to Dennis, and although many researchers have argued that in likelihood he simply got lost, he managed to get away far enough from his parents before they realized that he was missing and they simply weren't able to find him. Sure, that's the likeliest explanation, but having gone there myself, Jason Pentrail and I, hiked up there, having seen where he vanished, the window of time that would have allowed that boy to vanish off the face of the earth like he did was extremely narrow, between 3 and 5 minutes. That doesn't mean that he fell through a time warp or a portal, or that he was kidnapped by a Sasquatch, or anything along those lines. Again, if we're going to responsibly study something like Sasquatch, I don't think that proposing that they're out there kidnapping kids in national parks is necessarily the best way to go about that, and I don't think that's what happened to Dennis Martin, not in the slightest. But having been there to the site of the disappearance, having read the available National Park Service documents, and understanding that there is, of course, still that other possibility that maybe a kidnapping could have occurred, it definitely makes me wonder why the FBI continue to withhold some of the files, files which I happen to know exist based on interviews and references that are made in the National Park Service documents and newspaper accounts, but which, when I've written to the FBI and filed formal FOIA requests and have been as specific and thorough as I possibly can in referencing conversations, interviews, files, etc., they either say they can't find the files or that those records do not exist at all, which to me conflicts with the fact that we know there is a large trove of documents that they have been withholding and which they have sent in completely redacted form to some researchers who have requested them over the years. So who knows, maybe I would have more success if I sent FOIA requests to the FBI about mystery booms than I have had with the Dennis Martin disappearance. But if anything, the FBI's responses have propelled my interest in the boy's disappearance for one main reason, because although I err on the side of caution, and I expect that in likelihood Dennis wandered away, was either injured and or got lost, and his parents, under unusual circumstances, were unable to find him, and that there are probably unusual but nonetheless explicable circumstances that account for his disappearance, for the FBI to get involved, a number of things would have to be considered, all of which we won't get into right now, but two that I will mention as we're wrapping up this segment are this. If a homicide or an alleged kidnapping might have occurred, then the FBI would have gotten involved. And if indeed what happened to Dennis Lloyd Martin is believed to simply be a disappearance where a child got lost in a national park, and there is no evidence supporting a kidnapping or a homicide, then again, it seems very strange that there is a large collection of files we know the FBI has, but which they refuse to release after more than half a century. So maybe there are still some loose ends to tie up with this case, but we won't know until those files are released. All right, we're going to shift gears and look deep into space at the mystery of fast radio bursts when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Glad, as always, to be your host as we go in exploration of the universe and in search of answers behind its great mysteries. I do want to remind you, of course, if you enjoy this program and would like to show support and get a little something for it, you can head on over there to MicahHanks.com/podcast. That's where you can get all of the episodes of this program. And, of course, up there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you can click the X subscriptions link. Become an X subscriber. Had a few of you guys signing up over the weekend. So glad, as always, to have you guys joining our ranks here in the dark heart of the Hollow Earth. In fact, a little later in this hour, I'd like to get into a little about that topic. What's happening below ground with Becky Ferreira when she joins us here on the program. We've got a lot to discuss with her. But again, X subscriptions are a great way not only to get access to this podcast and all of the additional content, but on your own specialized RSS feed. And don't forget about those Enigmas specials. There's always something to look forward to with an X subscription. That's just $7 a month or $77 a year. So take your podcasting interests beyond the bunker. Although we're about to go beyond planet Earth for this next segment, because as we've touched on a little in the past few weeks, astronomers have been quite impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. And PhysOrg reported on this recently. They noted that scientists have been unable to take advantage of the pristine skies over, for instance, Chile's Atacama Desert since late March, when its array of world-renowned observatories were shuttered. That means humans will be oblivious to what astronomers call randomly occurring transitory phenomena, like gamma ray bursts or supernovas lost forever to the starry wastes. Any GRB, that's a gamma ray burst, or supernova that goes off while we're shut down, we can't really observe it. We will have missed the opportunity to observe it because it catches on so fast and then fades away, so it's these opportunities that are lost, says astronomer John Carpenter. Not to be confused with the director of the same name, I suppose. It's also a critical time, as many of you know, to be observing Betelgeuse, the giant red star in the constellation of Orion, the 10th brightest star in the night sky, which, as we know, has been suddenly dimming. This has prompted a lot of speculation about what could be the cause behind that. And as Carpenter notes, they had apparently been in the process of starting a campaign to observe and monitor Betelgeuse right about the time that they had to close their observatory, so now they can't continue. Now, of course, a lot of people are still watching the skies. A lot of citizen astronomers are able to do this. I have a telescope, but it's not on par with what they have out there in the Atacama Desert. And that, of course, is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA, an observatory whose 66 antennae combine to make the world's most advanced radio telescope. So it must be frustrating for astronomers who are unable to view the sky like they once did, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some discoveries being made. You know, we have this one from Cornell University via archive.org, and that's archive with an X, mind you. But the paper, which was submitted on June 4th, is titled Evidence for Magnetic Activity at Starbirth, a Powerful X-Ray Flare from the Class Zero Protostar, HOPS 383. Class Zero protostars, I'm reading now from the abstract on this paper. These Class Zero protostars represent the earliest evolutionary stage of solar-type stars, during which the majority of the system mass resides in an infalling envelope of gas and dust and is not yet in the central nascent star. Although X-rays are a key signature of magnetic activity in more evolved protostars and young stars, whether such magnetic activity is present at the Class Zero stage is still debated. And so the scientists in this study aimed to detect a bona fide Class Zero protostar using X-rays. How were they able to do this? They observed the HOPS 383, and this goes back to 2017, in X-rays using the Chandra X-ray Observatory and in near-infrared imaging with the Southern Astrophysical Research Telescope. The results were that HOPS 383 was detected in X-rays during a powerful flare. The hard X-ray counterpart was spatially coincident, they say, with the northwest 4-centimeter component of HOPS 383, which would be the base of the radiothermal jet launched by HOPS 383. They go on to note a little about the flare duration, the X-ray luminosity, and the like. But in essence, what we're seeing here is that the detection of a powerful X-ray flare from HOPS 383 supports direct proof that this magnetic activity can be present at the earliest formative stages of solar-type stars. Good thing those observations were made back in December of 2017, because at least since February or March of this year, astronomers haven't been able to be as actively engaged. But I mention this study here to point out that that doesn't mean the discoveries aren't being made. And in fact, that reminds me of an article that we touched on last week about just how mysterious some of the phenomena we're observing out there in the universe actually is. And I'm happy to say that the author of that article now joins us here on the program. I've followed her work for quite a while. Becky Ferreira is a Canadian writer based in New York. She's a regular contributor to Motherboard and Vice and has written for Wired, Popular Science, New Scientist, Bike Radar, and SparkNotes, among other publications. She's appeared on the Science Channel series NASA's Unexplained Files. And today I want to talk with her about a very unique variety of mystery that's occurring out there in space. Scientists have been observing these for more than a decade now. They're called fast radio bursts. We're going to get into all of that with her right now. But first, Becky, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's really a treat to have you here. Because I know that since earlier this year, you've been reporting on some of the really intriguing developments related to a long-held mystery, something that you and I both follow. Fast radio bursts, or FRBs as they are known. For anybody who doesn't know what these are, maybe can you give us first just a brief overview?
Yeah, so they're definitely one of the most tantalizing mysteries out there in the universe right now. So they're just very short, like millisecond long blasts of incredibly intense light. They tend to come from very distant galaxies. I think the closest one that we've ever discovered that's not in the Milky Way is like 500 million light years away. So it's very, very distant stuff. And basically nobody knows what the source is.
Back in 2007, if we kind of go back, tracing the roots of this phenomenon, when scientists first detected an FRB, it was believed this might actually be something else entirely. I know you've written about this. What were scientists' initial attitudes about the FRBs in terms of what they thought they might be and what caused this attitude to change?
So, and when they first detected, they thought, you know, it's got to be something that is capable of producing in a huge amount of light and energy. So supernovas were a candidate at first. I think in 2016, that was when the really kind of fascinating thing happened, where they discovered that some of them repeat. Some of them are not transient. They don't. There's a lot of them that astronomers have only seen once, but there are a few of them that come from the same place and they have the same pulses, and so that was like a huge breakthrough, because that can't be a supernova. It has to be some other kind of exotic model or theory behind that. So there's I think dozens of explanations for what that could be, and now we're starting to find, just within the last couple of months, two examples where not only these bursts are repeating, they have a periodicity to them. They have a pattern within the way that they emit their flashes. So that's truly another layer of mystery.
Oh, yeah. Again, very compelling. The first known repeater that you're referring to there, FRB 121102, they give them the most exciting names, don't they? But this one has come back into focus for you with your reporting on Signals from Space, because there have been some promising developments with this first known repeater. What have scientists managed to spot in its behavior?
Well, it's got a very long period. I mean, this is one of the reasons they were able to even figure out that there was a period, is that this is the first one that's sort of been, it's like the flashiest, so they've been studying it for years, and they were able to get enough data on it that they saw that there's this period of about 90 days of flash and then 57 days of quiet. So it's like it's emitting its flares for this weird, almost 100-day long period, and then it goes quiet for a bit. And so that's like, it definitely challenges some of the other theories. Like, for example, one of the main theories about what these bursts might be is that they are this kind of flare from a very cool object called a magnetar, which is a very condensed stellar core. But it's not really expected that a magnetar would produce a signature that would go on for that long. So, one of the things that they're sort of, that scientists are putting forward as a theory now is that perhaps this is an object that's orbiting another object, and that these quiet phases that you see where you're not having bursts, could be that, you know, the object is eclipsing, the source of the bursts, or that there's some other interaction going on that, maybe when they're close, there are more bursts. But this is all stuff that's still kind of getting hashed out right now.
Oh, yeah. Still a lot of work to do. Now, isn't FRB 121102 actually expected to be in its active phase right now? I think it was expected to enter it last week, right?
Yeah. It was. It's supposed to start again on June 2nd with this recent study that came out just a week or two ago. Unfortunately, the pandemic means that, like, the actual group that produced the study, they can't actually get to their data. The Jodrell Bank Telescope, where they were monitoring this FRB, is shut down right now. So they are hoping that they can get that information in a couple weeks. I'm sure that there's other observatories that are checking to see if that June 2nd, prediction is true. In their study, they say this is a tentative period, I should note, but that, you know, they'll be able in a month or two to be to have that confirmation of whether it's become an active flare again.
Right. I saw Costa Brajwadi, the astronomer at the University of Manchester, kind of lamenting the fact that astronomers aren't able to get into their observatories in the midst of this pandemic, and so it really limits what we're able to look for out there in space, and there seem to be a lot of exciting discoveries right now. But, you know, I try to see the positive in things like this, yeah. Becky. And so maybe is it actually a benefit in some ways that by analyzing the data as they are doing, astronomers are actually finding some incredible things while working from home.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this time has really forced everybody to have ingenuity and like kind of improvise these kinds of things. I'm not sure in particular what people are doing with the FRBs right now, but there's certainly like all kinds of people have a home setup where they're monitoring these kinds of observations from the observatories that are still active and trying to keep everything going. And, you know, there's also, like I should mention, that a lot of interesting new observatories, such as one called CHIME in British Columbia, that are like very, very good at detecting these transients. They're, as you can imagine, they're quite difficult to detect because they're so short. So you need to really be looking at the right place at the right time. So I think that there's probably quite a few people looking through the CHIME data and all these other places right now from home, even though they can't, you know, like, fortunately, a lot of observatories are automatically or they don't need like manual. They don't need someone there to work them. So there's still data coming in and lots of work to be done.
Yeah, that's always hopeful. Again, we're talking with Becky Ferreira, reporter for Vice. And when we come back after this, I want to get a little deeper into this mystery of fast radio bursts. With her, what exactly are we looking at? What have scientists proposed might be the mechanism behind the mystery that we're observing here? I am Micah Hanks. We will be back with Becky Ferreira right after this. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Our guest, Becky Ferreira, Canadian writer based in New York, regular contributor to Motherboard and Vice. And we're discussing fast radio bursts, which she's been reporting on both in recent days and also back in February. We've got some fairly significant updates in terms of what science has to say about these and, more importantly, some of the behavior that we are observing with them. So let's get right back into things. Becky, so far as what the FRB that you've been reporting on since February appears to be doing, what are the specifics of its behavior and the periodicity of its flashing?
Yeah, sorry, I think I might have gotten it wrong earlier in the interview that it's. I think I might have said 57 days, but yeah, it goes on for this 157-day cycle, and yeah, it's dark for 67 days of that.
Right. It brings back your article from February to mind, where you wrote about another FRB, this one designated 1809-16. This one, yet again, those names, but this one,
I know, right?
it's about a...
It's been like more one of the complicated, like, astronomical names, like when the names of the pulsars and things like that are crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's where it starts getting really interesting. Now, this one is about 450 million light years from Earth, as I understand it. It displays an active phase. As you wrote earlier this year, it appears to be with clustered flashes that last for just 4 days. This one followed by a quiet period that lasts only 12 days. So there seems to be a lot of variety in the periodicity of their awake and dark stages.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, we only have these two that have an established period. And it was a really exciting result. I mean, that was the first time that one in I think it was February that was in fact, I think, the CHIME collaboration that discovered that pattern, and that was the first time that it ever had any pattern discovered. So it's obviously way shorter, and there's a couple that one could potentially be this explanation of a magnetar or precessing or something like that. It's short enough. It's a little bit not a great fit, but it could be that. But then it you know, finding something where it's like literally, yeah, it's 10 times longer. it's a huge range. So that's one of the big unknowns right now, is just how many of these repeating FRBs have this kind of this period, and how long can they get? And so, you know, obviously when you're trying to constrain something And it has that kind of range. It's very exciting. And I mean, it could also be with the 16-day cycle, that could also be an orbital period that's much shorter. So that was another explanation that was posited for that one. But yeah, it's certainly like just fascinating that they have such a difference between their periods. And also, you know, that right now so many people are working to try to establish if this is a thing that other repeaters are doing.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned magnetars a couple of times. I often think of them, since they are essentially dead stars, I kind of think of them like a celestial zombie. They produce a very intense magnetic field. Now, some I actually think that that does not necessarily explain some of the FRBs. I did want to ask you, Becky, what have experts you have spoken to proposed? I know that there are a variety of theories. What are some of the other ideas that they have put forth in terms of what some of these FRBs might represent?
Yeah, well, they could still, some of the ones that are transient, assuming that we never find, you know, that they're all repeaters, which would be pretty exciting. The ones yeah. that are transient could be, you know, these incredibly big, like, cosmic cataclysms, like, you know, two neutron stars, which are, you know, as you know, these dead zombie stars as well, colliding, you know, catastrophic collisions between other types of extremely massive stars could produce these really big flashes. One of the reasons the magnetar theory has so much sway is that the light from these bursts is very polarized, suggesting that there's a very intense magnetic field involved in whatever is producing them. So that makes them a very exciting thing. But, you know, anything, there's lots of things with intense magnetic fields. So it could definitely be a number of different sources. Some of these could be those really intense collisions. Maybe some are like two exotic bodies in a orbital pattern that you're seeing this kind of period with. Or yeah, you could just have these magnetars. I mean, I was actually just, you know, in preparing for talking to you, I saw over the weekend that there's quite good evidence that we've had a FRB within the Milky Way. I don't want to get too ahead of myself because I haven't done reporting on that story, but that seems to be related to a magnetar. So one of the things I think would be really exciting is just if this is a whole class of different objects, different sources that produce very similar signals.
Yeah, I am right there with you. And, you know, again, I think it's really important to look at natural explanations before we go to more exotic theories. But again, in the last few years, we have, you know, heard some discussion about the possibility of, and again, to borrow a term that NASA has used, technosignatures. How might evidence of technology somewhere very far out there, you know, far distant from Earth, how might we be able to perceive that here on Earth? Now, obviously, it seems like it's a very unlikely possibility, but can we rule out those kinds of possibilities as we are studying these phenomena out there in deep space?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's it reminds me a bit of when, you know, the discovery of pulsars and things like that again. So just the fact that I think humans really, when we see something that's clockwork and has a regular period and is like, you know, reminds us of the way that we constructed our civilization on these types of things, it can be very appealing to be like, well, that's definitely an ET and they're definitely flashing lights at us. Of course, it can't be ruled out. And maybe, you know, some of these transient flashes or something like that could be technological. But I think it's for me, you know, reporting on, you know, with what the researchers, most researchers do not think that's a likely origin, of course, because it's just, there's plenty of natural explanations, you know, as I mentioned, like literally dozens of different models that people have put together to explain this. So, but you know, if we're thinking about ourselves in terms of us wanting to create our own technological signals that could be seen, I mean, these are great for showing that how much energy you need to do that for, right? Like we're seeing like the FRB 12-11-02, for instance, that's like 3 billion light years away. So that's a huge signal. So if we really want to imagine ourselves, have the hubris to imagine ourselves as a species that could communicate across that distance, that's how much energy you would need to create that kind of signal.
That is a really great point that you make there, Becky, because even though it is likely that there is a natural phenomena being observed here, if we are able to understand it, this might help us in our future efforts as far as SETI goes. Although there are always those who have warned that could be a dangerous thing. We're talking with Becky Ferreira. When we come back after this, I want to turn our attention from space toward the underground and one of her articles talking about mysterious structures below the Earth here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, rounding out our conversation with Becky Ferreira, contributor to Vice and many other publications. You can find out more about her work, which we'll have linked in the show notes, at beckyferreira.com, or just do a search for her at Vice. You also find her articles there and in other places online. Now, getting over into the conversation about what's happening below ground, something that really intrigued me about one of your recent articles, Becky, has to do with Earth structures deep below the surface. We've talked about the idea of technosignatures or even mega structures, which astronomers keep looking for, but deep beneath the Earth, seismologists have discovered structures of a very different kind. Do you mind if we talk about those a little?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love the deep core stuff. It's fascinating.
Yeah, there's something that's very appealing about it, and I'm kind of drawn to it also. One of the interesting things about this deep Earth structure that you wrote about in your recent article is that its discovery was aided by machine learning. So let's talk about this particular AI algorithm. Ironically enough, which was analyzed or designed to analyze distant galaxies. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It was trained to look for the relationship between galaxy mass and supermassive black holes or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what they have ended up detecting are called mega ULVZs. What exactly are these? Where were they found and what might they mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are these incredibly kind of dense patches on the boundary of the lower mantle of the Earth and the outer edge of the liquid core. So you've got the solid core and then the liquid core. So they're right on the edge of that liquid core. So I think that's about 1,800 miles or so beneath our feet right now. And the biggest patch, I think, is around the size of Florida. And so they're quite large, and you can actually see the way that, you know, scientists detect them is to look at seismic waves that are produced by earthquakes. They slow down. These waves slow down inside of these zones. So that's how they can tell that there's something weird and dense there. As for what they are, it's kind of like the fast radio burst. Like there's, you know, we're not quite sure. They just seem to be maybe partially melted kind of rock. And in this new study, while there's been a lot of ULVZs that are identified and mapped out in past studies, this one found one that had never been seen that was previously undetected under the Marquesas Islands, and then it also found that one that was known under Hawaii was much bigger than people originally thought, and that was thanks to the machine learning algorithm that kind of mapped out these two things.
Yeah, this is fantastic. One of the things that really was interesting to me about this is because of the exotic materials that these are believed mm-hmm. to be composed of, they may date back to a time before Earth had a moon. What might that indicate about this formation process?
It's a great question. And I that really stuck out in the study to me too. I thought that was so fascinating. So it might be that these are just really, really ancient parts of Earth that have been hanging out in the middle of the Earth for billions of years. So the dominant theory for how the moon formed is that, you know, a Mars-sized object hit early Earth about like 4.4, I think, billion years ago. And, you know, there may have been Earth at that time may have had a magma ocean covering it because it was just getting pelted by all the asteroids and random space rocks that were very that were all over the early universe. So it could be that this is these structures are like part of that old magma ocean that a lot of people think, formed the moon, that when this was blasted out into space by this big impact, that coalesced into the moon, this kind of magma hunk of rock that became, you know, very important to the habitability of our Earth. We, you know, depend on the moon for a lot of our evolution. So, sorry, I got a little bit off track there, but
it's okay.
But you know what I mean? Like it's one of the frustrating things about when you report on things that are happening in the deep Earth is that you can't actually go and sample it. But this could really be like melt from the same from the time before the Earth had ever even produced its moon, which is really exciting stuff.
Absolutely. We still have a lot of questions about how the moon was formed, exactly what relationship it plays not only to Earth, but you know what that might actually indicate for other planets, and indeed, whether having a moon like Earth does may be a key to life on a planet like Earth as we're out there looking for the potential for extraterrestrial life. You know, Becky, there's so much we could talk about. I know that your time's limited. I want to thank you again for jumping on the mic with us. What is coming up for you? What are you looking into, and what's next from Becky Ferreira?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm very excited about the Mars missions that are coming up in July. The Perseverance rover with its little helicopter is being launched then. At least it's on track to. And there may be also a Chinese mission to Mars as well, which would be very exciting. So those should both launch this summer. I'm looking forward to those. And I'm also writing a piece right now for Vice about amateur sky gazing and astrophotography, because I think, you know, right now a lot of people really want to take up a hobby, and people have been doing the gardening and doing all kinds of other fun activities. And I think it's the perfect time to go out and start looking at the stars more too.
I agree. Well, Becky Ferreira, thank you again for joining us. We'll have your website linked there in the show notes, and I'm sure it won't be the last time we hear from you.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Becky Ferreira, of course, can be found online at BeckyFerreira.com, and we'll have that linked in the show notes. When we come back after this, as we're wrapping things up, I want to shift our attention over to another article that broke just this morning, having to do with scientists who may believe that there are alien civilizations communicating in our galaxy right now. We'll look at that right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Thanks again to Becky Ferreira, who joined us to discuss the enduring mystery of fast radio bursts. Hopefully she can join us again at some point. Had a lot of great input on that topic and other things, too. Now, there was this interesting article that broke earlier today, which I felt warranted mention here in the final segment. And this one featured at a number of sites, the one I'm referencing here, Sky News, 36 alien civilizations could be communicating in our galaxy, new research claims. Now, they say no direct evidence has been found for any intelligent extraterrestrial life forms, but a study led by the University of Nottingham puts a number on how many civilizations we should be looking for. And this is based on estimates from a recent study that they published in the Astrophysical Journal. And they say that based on the assumption that intelligent life would evolve on other planets in the same way that it has on Earth, we should be looking for around 36 potential communicating extraterrestrial intelligent civilizations, or CETI. That's what they call these, alien civilizations like our own, which broadcast radio signals into space. Sky News reports that Professor Christopher Consalis, an astrophysicist at Nottingham, explained there should be at least a few dozen active civilizations in our galaxy, and he notes that is under the assumption that it takes 5 billion years for intelligent life to form on other planets, as it did on Earth. Now, of course, that is an assumption, and I'm glad that they point that out, because there are a lot of factors that govern whether a civilization is likely to rise to prominence, as one did on Earth, that has the technological capability to engage in communication along these lines. I would actually argue it might take far less time on certain planets, and it has a lot to do with whether or not a planet perhaps exists in near proximity to an asteroid belt where there are large space rocks that are likely to collide with that planet and sort of restart the clock on life cycles that occur there. We know that in the geological history of this planet, there is a lot of evidence for impacts that have killed off large megafaunal species. There is a growing abundance of evidence in support of a smaller scale event that occurred around 12,800 years ago. In fact, one of the chief critics who had argued against that, volcanologist Mark DeFont, has recently reversed his position on that idea. He had appeared along with skeptic Michael Shermer on the Joe Rogan podcast, and they had been engaged in a debate with Graham Hancock and my good pal Randall Carlson. Now, since there have been an abundance of scientific papers forthcoming since they had that debate on Joe's podcast that seem to support the idea of the what is called the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, Michael Shermer has since come out and said that he is becoming more convinced that this indeed probably did occur, and Mark DeFont, the volcanologist, has also said essentially the same thing, that although they had been skeptical initially, the abundance of evidence that has been forthcoming seems to suggest otherwise. But again, getting back to the main argument here, these kinds of cataclysmic events can cause serious disruptions in the technological progression of a civilization on a planet, and may also potentially wipe out life forms that may eventually become technologically sophisticated. And it may not be the case that all planets' inhabitable regions of space are necessarily as prone to having close encounters with extraterrestrial objects as Earth has been in the past. So maybe we shouldn't presume that it would necessarily take so long as billions of years for intelligent life to come about on an alien planet. But nonetheless, that is the working assumption that Professor Christopher Consolis and others in this current study have been working with. He goes on to say the idea is looking at evolution, but on a cosmic scale. We call this calculation the astrobiological Copernican limit, which essentially has two conditions or assumptions based on what we know about intelligent civilizations from here on Earth. According to Sky News, basically, these conditions suggest that for planets which are like Earth within a star's habitable zone and have the right distribution of elements, intelligent communicating life will evolve between 4.5 and 5.5 billion years after the planet forms. Going by this principle, the researchers say that there should be at least 36 civilizations within our own galaxy. And they say, in fact, that's the lower limit, assuming these civilizations only last 100 years based on how long Earth has been a communicating civilization. But here's one of the key points to drive home. If these civilizations are evenly spread throughout the galaxy, then our nearest SETI civilization could be 17,000 light years away, which would make it practically impossible to communicate with them. They add, according to the article here, that the likelihood that the host stars for this life are similar to our own in terms of mass is also extremely small. Again, they're talking about the stars, not the life that we would hope would exist there. And again, if these stars have extremely small mass, then most of them would be unstable red dwarfs. So they are in the right range as far as age, but they might not be in the right range in terms of habitability and the ability to support life. But let's say that, again, we do find a planet that is very Earth-like somewhere far out there. As Becky Ferreira pointed out earlier, it may be that through studying natural forms of phenomena that we are observing out there, and we see what kind of energy is required in order to produce something along those lines, we may eventually be able to create systems that do allow communication over great distances. And through our continuing studies of astronomy, space, and the cosmos, it may also eventually lead to the understanding of other ways that communication might take form. And more importantly, other forms of communication that might already be in use by alien civilizations out there who may be looking, as we do, for life like them. So maybe we'll find evidence of aliens once we find aliens looking for us. That'll be the final word for this week's edition of the program. As always, thanks for being here. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. As always, I am your host, Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and stay strange out there.